Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to part two of the French Connection. My name again is Daryl Bradford Smith. It's great to have you here on this 20th day of April 2006. I'm calling you from central France, and my guest today is going to be on the radio from Wales in Great Britain. His name is Neil Turner, and Neil is a researcher and a family man, as you can all hear. It's, you know, this is live radio for us. We're doing this information from our hearts, from our souls, ladies and gentlemen, right to you. This is not from our office in Langley, Virginia, or over at Scotland Yard or any other place. This is coming from our homes and out to you. Anyway, Neil, are you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you, Donald.
Wonderful to have you here, Neil. You know, we talked a little bit yesterday about some subjects that I wanted to touch on. One of them, you know as well as I do that I live in a country that doesn't allow me to investigate certain subjects.
The Fabius Geisert Law.
Well, you know, and that's the way it is, and because I value my efforts outside of a jail cell, I prefer to stay away from certain research, so I really don't have any opinion about revisionism either one way or the other. My point being now, I'd like to bring up with you first subject, is your take on jailing people for looking into a historical event. How incredible is that? And did you ever believe in your lifetime that they would be able to jail people for asking a question about history?
Not when I was younger, but now I've got a bit older, anything is possible.
Well,
and they have to shut them up to keep them quiet. I don't know if you've been following the Zundel trial.
Yes.
But the defense for Zundel is in the position that under German Penal Code 130, if they try to bring evidence to defend Zundel, the defense team gets arrested. They get thrown in the slammer. So it's a catch-22. You just cannot defend yourself.
And do you have to be German to fall under that law, or is that a European-wide law?
It's a European, I believe all states in the EU now subscribe to it, though Tony Blair has said he won't put it into practice in the UK. But theoretically, in the UK, we're under the same law.
Well, I've never seen anybody jailed in France for it, and there's a man named Abby Pierre over
mm-hmm.
here, and Abby Pierre has come right out and said, you know, he believes that is nonsense, and he doesn't subscribe to the conventional wisdom, and he's still running the streets. And what happened to Jean-Marie Le Pen for saying that the Holocaust was a small detail in history?
Mm-hmm.
They fined him €1,000, I think. But two researchers, academics, one of them from Lyon 2, was arrested for revisionism, and all they did was fine him. He lost his job. He did lose his job. But
well,
they did not jail anybody. Nobody gets jailed in France, from what I know.
Well, what they tend to do is strip them of any tenorship they have in colleges or universities.
Yeah.
There was one French revisionist who had his PhD revoked, lost his pension. And for me, the guy who started it all was a guy called Paul Racinier.
Yeah.
And he was of the real resistance in France. He wasn't one of these latecomer communist resistance. He used to help Jews escape deportation, and he was passing them through France when he got arrested by the Gestapo. And he spent time in Buchenwald and a place called Dara, where he used to make the B-2 rockets.
Yeah.
And when he was liberated after the war, he came back and saw all these stories of gassings and whatnot in Buchenwald and said, hey, you know, what's going on? Now, he could have written his memoirs, taken the money, and lived a comfortable life, but he went for the truth. And as such, he was castigated.
Well, you know, here's the interesting thing about this stuff, okay? And again, I don't really want to get into details because it might put me on the spot. But you know, when you take a look at this situation, there was some horrific things that happened to everybody. I mean, those camps had gypsies. They had mental defectives. In other words, they emptied out their insane asylums. They
mm-hmm.
they filled up the if you were a known homosexual, you were shipped off to one of these places.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a pretty interesting collection of people that the Nazi regime were deemed as enemies, and most of them, however, were communists. Am I correct?
Yep, because, well, when Hitler won the elections in 1933, it was expected that the communists would achieve victory. And, well, things didn't go according to plan. And he took over, and he wanted America and Britain to join him in the fight against Bolshevism, because they'd sworn to flood Europe and take over. In fact, when Hitler decided to invade Russia, the Russians were already on the borders waiting to attack Europe. They wanted Germany and England to just fight each other to a standstill, and then they would step in.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a preemptive attack by the Germans, which prolonged the war somewhat. War is hell. You can see what's going on in Iraq right now.
Well, yes.
And it's the victors who write history. These camps, a lot of them were industrial complexes.
Yeah.
They were knocking out stuff for the German war effort.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
If you look at what happened after the war, okay, we can criticize, or the powers to be can criticize what the Germans did, but Jacques Bach wrote a book, Other Losses, in which he detailed the death of 1 million German prisoners of war after the war in French and American concentration prisoner of war camps. And nothing said about this. These men were deliberately killed.
Well, and interestingly enough, could have been saved. I think we did an article, or there's an article on judicialbiz.org, where you can read about what's his name, Eisenhower, knew that there were these prisoners that needed food, and there was sickness raging through the ranks of this camp that they were holding these prisoners in,
mm-hmm.
and instead of taking action to save them, he didn't send them food and he didn't send them medicine. And basically let them rot behind barbed wire.
Well, in fact, he passed a law that any woman or children, or anyone who tried to pass food through the fence to help the starving prisoners, were to be shot.
And this was Eisenhower that did that.
Yeah, he passed this law.
Yep.
And but for whatever reason, he absolutely hated the Germans, in total contrast of how Patton felt about them. Maybe that's why Patton met an untimely demise.
Well, that's what they say, you know, and it seemed to be and interestingly, Patton said the real enemy was the Russians, and we should have just, you know, got our sixth army together, and he said, I'll go all the way to Moscow if you want me to. And, of course, that didn't go over very well with his controllers, huh?
Well, after the end of the Second World War, Churchill said, I think we killed the wrong pig, in reference to the Russians.
Well,
you know, hindsight is wonderful.
Well,
but,
you know,
I mean, if you look at what happened to Dresden during the war, I mean,
yeah.
The Ural bombing, it's funny, there was a movie called Enola Gray, and it was on about British and American bomber commands going over Germany. And there's one scene where the American bomber will not drop his bombs in case it hits civilian targets. Well, they were deliberately targeting civilian targets. It was called the Lindemann Plan, and it was supposed to strike terror in the hearts of the Germans. And it was deliberately targeted upon working-class districts where the houses were packed in. They wanted to kill as many people as possible. I mean, nobody knows how many died at Dresden. They say 20, 30 years more, like in the hundreds of thousands, because the bodies just melted.
Yeah.
When they went in after the bombings, there was this strange goo covering the place, and it was the remains of human beings.
Well, and not only that, I mean, it caused firestorms that raged for weeks. And I understand, too, that they attempted a firestorm event in Hamburg. And the population in Hamburg fought back with fire equipment to some degree and saved a lot of the city. But Hamburg almost went up like Dresden.
It was all of the German cities. I saw a BBC documentary about Bomber Command. And they said, was it by mid-44, the war was virtually over, and Bomber Command had nothing left to do. So they chose small towns on B roads, and they described one town where they flew over it, and by morning, the town had disappeared. There was 1,500 people, and all because a B road ran through the village. They just wiped it out, and they were doing this all over Germany.
Yeah. Well, and Germany today is still they have been emasculated, the nation, and they're held down under under this shame. I mean, they are constantly beaten back with the world saying, shame on you, Germany, and you are Nazis, and na-na-na. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is the leadership over there, Merkel and the rest of these crooks, are working with the Zionists.
Well, they know. If they don't, if they open their mouths, they go to jail. There's the option. You know, you write wonderful books saying how bad the Nazis were, and you will achieve fame and fortune.
Yeah.
It's straight out of the protocols. Whoever wrote those protocols, it's the same as in Japan. The Americans did the same thing. They destroyed the country with the firebombs, the nuclear bombs, and yet the Japanese are held up to being the monsters.
Yeah.
History is written by the victors.
Well, you know, and right now we're in a situation where the Middle East is going up in flames, and we're poisoning the environment there for billions of years with this depleted uranium. And oddly enough, they're finding 600% increases in surface radiation in Britain.
The Alder Marston report.
Yeah. I mean, what we're doing is a genocide in this region.
Well, an interesting fact about that, the man who wrote the report, a guy called Busby, he couldn't get hold of the information for 2003 from the Atomic Weapons Establishment. So he went through the Freedom of Information Act and then found out the reason he couldn't get the information was the government no longer ran this part of the Atomic Weapons Establishment. It was now being run by Halliburton. They are responsible for keeping radiation figures in the UK.
Who was?
Halliburton.
Halliburton,
The Cheney's boys, you know.
Oh, Brown and Root and Kellogg Brown and Root. Oh, the guys that are making all... that's Dick Cheney's old gang.
Yep.
Well, you know, we've been... I brought up a term that you said you didn't know a lot about, but you've got to look into these people. The Shabbat Lubavitch.
Mm-hmm.
And the Lubavitchers are photographed standing beside all of the main leaders of the United States, Cheney and Bush and Giuliani and Schwarzenegger and Schumer and all of the different congressmen, Leibowitz and all of these people. And you got to see these people. I mean, you know, they look like they're out of a comic book. I mean, I don't mean to make fun of people, but it looks, you know, people make fun of the Amish people. Are you familiar with the Amish?
I saw the movie Witness. I remember Harrison Ford's movie, yeah.
Well, you know, they wear the black clothes and the funny hats and everything, okay? And they look like nincompoops, but that's okay. I mean, you know, it's okay to say that Amish look like nincompoops, but take a look at some of these Orthodox. They're from some comic book. I can't believe that in a modern world these people have the kind of power that they have.
Well, they work on a herd mentality. You know, they keep together, you know, the stories of the Holocaust. You know, they're indoctrinated from a very early age. They keep them like a shoal of fish. They swim here and there, but they're always in a group. And they're fantastically well organized, and they support each other. I mentioned to you yesterday about the outreach program where they're flying young Jews from all over the world. They first take them to Auschwitz, where they scare the hell out of them. And then they take them to Israel, where they are made to feel safe. And when in Israel, they put through a two-week course at the Yeshiva College, and they are indoctrinated with the Talmud. And the Talmud says the only human beings on the face of the earth are the Jews. Mm. And that the Gentiles are like the issue of horses. That is, we are part animal. So you can kill a Gentile with impunity, because all you're doing is killing an animal. Now, when you have a race of people brought up to believe this, you've got problems. Napoleon, he had a conference back in 1806. It was a conference of the Sanhedrin. And these were mainly Sephardic Jews, the real Jews from the line of Isaac.
Yeah.
And he got them to promise that they would no longer remain outside of the nations. They would join with the nations. Unfortunately, nobody knew of the Ashkenazim in Poland and Eastern Europe. Mm-hmm. And they did nothing to do with this. And so the promise didn't last for long.
Yeah.
So when you've got a group of people who look down on the rest of humanity as animals, you guarantee problems.
Well, and then what you do is you mix this madness, this cult belief system with lots of money and a willingness to do any whatever it takes to win. And you are looking at a conspiracy that is threatening to engulf every person on the planet.
Well, you mentioned about the depleted uranium. That's certainly in the earth. I mean, it's taken out Israel as well. You know, if we've got a 600% spike in the UK, just think of what it's doing to the Israelis.
Yeah.
So no one wins in this game. And the thing is, though, with now I know you said you're a secularist yourself, or a libertarian, was it?
Yes, libertarian, that's right.
Okay, so I mean, if you're religious, you have an idea of the hereafter, yeah? And you're aware of it in your daily life. Whereas these sects of the Jews, this is paradise, here and now on earth. And you just go for it. So there's nothing to tempt your conduct as to what you will achieve in the next life. Now, I know you don't have these beliefs in the year after, but then it doesn't affect you that way. Because you haven't been taught this. You haven't been brought up thinking you're superior to other human beings.
Everybody, I think, everybody, I thought, because there's this voice inside me, Neil, and it says, oh, don't do that. That would hurt somebody. And,
And
I mean, it's called my conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where it came from. Did it come from my parents? Did it come from I don't know. But I've always known that if I did certain things, it would hurt people. And I got to be honest with you, as a younger man, sometimes I made the wrong decision, and knowing that it would injure people, and it did, and I had to be hurt psychically inside myself. I had to be hurt. The fact of the matter is, though, how can you go throughout your life knowing that the acts you commit are injuring others, and that's sociopathic. That's somebody who has no sense of moral responsibility and no and Jesus. What kind of monsters are we developing here?
Don't forget, you're talking about how would you be today if you would have someone tell you were superior to other human beings and they don't count. That if you want to take possession of their possessions, then it's okay. That if you were called to a Gentile court of law, you can tell lies. There's no problem. If you were brought up with this, then you're not going to have the same mindset as you were talking of now.
Well, you're right, and I mean, I got on in a conversation with a Hasidic rabbi, and of course he tried to sell me the idea that goyim didn't mean anything except foreigner. And I said, excuse me, Rabbi, that's nonsense, man. I mean, come on, dude. You sell that to somebody else. I know what it means, and it's a pejorative term. And don't lie to me.
I've talked to a Jewish friend who converted to Islam.
Yeah.
And he said, because the excuse is, when it says in the Talmud, the best of Gentiles, kill them. The normal excuse is, this was only supposed to apply to the Romans. But as my Jewish friend said, hey, if they meant that, they'd have said Romans, not Gentiles. They always keep making excuses. He made a wonderful comment in one of his talks. He said, the tribe of Shem have stolen the tents of Shem. What he meant was the tribe of the Shambolics, the imposters, the Ashkenazims. These are the Jews that lived in southern Russia and converted to Judaism in the 8th century. They have stolen the tents of Shem, who are the Ephraimites. The 10 tribes that left Israel.
Yeah.
They must have gone somewhere. And I was reading Flavius Josephus. He was a Jewish historian from Roman times. And he said about how the Celtic people are in fact descended from the tribe of Dan, one of the lost tribes.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked a Jewish friend about this. You know, he said, we believe the Celts are descended from the tribe of Dan. And he was an Ashkenazim, which made Celts, if you like, Israelites. So I was thinking of phoning up Ariel Sharon when I discovered this, and of course I was going to call him Collect and ask him if I could come home. What do you think he'd have said?
I'm coming back to roost over there, Ariel. But the problem is, and here's the thing, I've got great Jewish friends in New York. I got some in New England as well.
Mm-hmm.
They're not part of this, Neil. They don't. Many of them don't have a clue, and they're from the Ashkenazi sect, but they're kind of a religious. They're not going to their temple all the time, and they live like we do, where they struggle, you know, they eke out their living, and here's the problem. We can't broad brush everybody, because in order to be fair, we'll be as monstrous as them if we don't make allowances for people who have nothing to do with it.
I agree. The Jewish friend I go to when I want to know something, and he is so disgusted with them. He doesn't go to synagogue. He prefers to hang out with Gentiles. And we make jokes about the Goyims and whatnot. But if I told him, if real anti-Semitism did break out, I'd be the first one in front of his house with a baseball bat, or over here with a cricket bat, to protect him.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You can't just pick on the guy because he's Jewish.
That's
you
right.
Know, by their actions, you will know them.
That's right. And regardless of the things that, you know, they try to sell you, take a look at what they're doing. And, you know, I've often had to point out to people that the entire leadership of the White House, we've got 7 out of 10 people working in that White House Jewish. And I mean, all
right.
Of them.
Does that include George?
Well, you know, and even George, we're not sure if he's not a Jew.
Well, they did trace the lineage back to a book from about 17th century America or something, where they trace it back to Solomon Bush.
That's right.
As a respected member of the Jewish community.
Well, in fact, Solomon Bush was one of the new Bohemians who came over at the urgings of Weishaupt to open up some Masonic lodges.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact is, he very well may have roots in the Jewish community, and so too was Eisenhower. If you take a look at his graduation picture from West Point, it calls him the Swedish Jew.
The crazy Swedish Jew, I think he was, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, and then...
Maybe that explains why he acted like he did towards the Germans.
Possibly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what Untermeyer wanted to do, and he set out his goals for destruction of Germany back in the early 30s, and he addressed his private group, and we've got the transcripts of his announcements to these people, and boy, he pretty much laid it out, Neil, that... you know, we're gonna bring them to their knees financially, and then we're going to implode the country. But here's the interesting thing: in the beginnings of the Nazi era, there were a lot of Jews in the highest level of this organization. Were there not?
In what organization?
In the Nazi organization.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, the deputy of the Luftwaffe, a guy called Milch, he was Jewish, and some guy from Cambridge University, a guy called Rigg, did a book about it. And He names or mentions 1,200 Jews in the German forces. Well, in fact, they think it was thousands, not just 1,200. They were field marshals, generals. They were high up there because they were German Jews. We're German. We're not Jewish. We're German first. Right? This is why Untermeyer was part of, to me, the scam where they bring in, because you know in 1933 the front page of the Daily Express carried it, Judea declares war on Germany.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, so you put Germany in a position where I think she lost 20% of her export market in 2 years, and there were hard times in Germany. Then the Zionists come out and say, look, we've got the same agenda. You want the Jews out of Germany, and we want them into Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
So then they work together. They create the 35 race laws, which makes it almost nigh on impossible for Jews to make a decent living in Germany. And they're offered one alternative, and that is emigration to Palestine. And they couldn't go anywhere else.
Now,
they weren't allowed
fit,
to go anywhere else.
That dovetailed right in with the demands that had been made on Britain back in the 1917 signing of the Balfour document. So there was a continuity of this policy.
Yeah, well, Ben Friedman talked about this. Didn't
That's
he?
Right.
You know, hey,
and
give us Palestine, we'll bring America into the war.
That's right. And the continuity is that now that they've got Palestine on their guarantee list, now they've got to populate the place.
Yeah, but then the funny thing is, in 1941, they turned against the British because the Stern gang actually wrote a letter to some German high command in the Middle East somewhere, offering them to fight for the Germans against the British. So they just change sides when they see, well, whatever's good for them, that's the way they go.
Well, you know, the big victims right now, of course, 400 shells being dropped on a single weekend on the Gaza Strip.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, basically not to protect themselves from anything, but rather to strike fear and genocide that population. And, of course, they've cut off the Americans and the Europeans have cut off their access to capital, so they aren't going to get any food.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, there was a, I think it's a UN commission investigating Israeli war crimes scheduled.
Yeah. Mm.
And just a few hours or a few days before this commission started, you had the latest suicide bomb go off in Tel Aviv. Right, but where did it go off? It didn't go off in the Jewish district. It went off in a district where all the workers from other countries are housed.
Yeah.
So the people
so they could write their families and say, "Oh my God, that the Palestinians are attacking us again."
No, it's portrayed on certainly in the media here. You know, some more Jews died, but from what I understand, it was mostly immigrant workers from Eastern Europe. From Sri Lanka, from Thailand. You know, this place is a place of squalor. I mean, because what happens? They come into work, their passports are taken off them, and suddenly they don't get paid. What can they do? They can't go nowhere. They just got to keep on working and hope they get some food.
Really?
Yeah, this is what happens out there. I mean, I lived and worked in Saudi Arabia, and I saw this thing happen there in a few cases.
Well, we know that the House of Saud was actually a manifestation of the Rothschild group as well, that they needed a group, so they elevated this Bedouin family and to put them into power. And it's no different than what they did with Saddam Hussein over in the Ba'athist Party. And I mean, you take a look at the power politics in that region. Most of the governments are being controlled through their messianic control system. That, you know, this Hashemite stuff that comes in out of Jordan with King Hussein and the rest of them. I mean,
well, the interesting thing about Palestine is I got a little booklet written in the 30s about the mineral wealth of Palestine, and it is, well, at the time some people thought it to be the richest area in the world. The Dead Sea is such a valuable asset. Back in the 30s, the amount of gold salts in the Dead Sea were measured in the trillions of dollars. There's enough potash there to halve the price of fertilizer to farmers all over the world for the next 200 years. There's incredible amounts of natural resources there. So I don't think it was so much as it being the spiritual home for Jewry. It was the economic and commercial value of the country. It's a fantastically wealthy country, and there's quite a large oil deposit down there as well.
In Israel?
In Palestine. The Dead Sea area, yeah, it was fantastically wealthy. I mean, and then there were German government expeditions went out there, American, so many countries sent people and said, "Hey, this place is a gold mine."
Well, you know, we take a look at these things, and I can't even imagine, Neil, that at this late stage, 2006, we're still debating whether these people are trying to do us in. And the fact is, you and I know it as well as I'm breathing right now, and we don't get as much traction as we need to. And I can't imagine how the rest of the world is not signing on to these facts.
Well, it seems the only blip right now is in Iran and Venezuela. I don't know if you heard, but Chavez is going to form his own 9/11 commission to find out what's going on, what happened. The Iranian president, he's had a conference on the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few brave souls. And I just hope America doesn't go at it with Iran, because there's a lot of American soldiers and Navy people, they're going to die, because Iran has been tooled up by the Russians and the Chinese. They are not going to be the walkover that Iraq was, because Iraq was debilitated by 10 years of sanctions. There were more bombs dropped in Iraq in the 10 years between the wars than dropped in the first war.
Yeah.
You know, there was an English writer over here. She went out there, and they were down. They were blowing up herds of sheep, including the Shepherd boys. She was shown it. You know, British and American planes, they were just doing bombing runs. They were wiping out the food source of these people. Back in 1976, I don't know if David Pitcock mentioned it to you, but he was in contact with a guy called James Aitkins. He was a Saudi,
yeah,
ambassador to Saudi Arabia at one time.
That's right, yep.
And he attended a meeting, I'm not sure it was the Pentagon, and it was discussing the depopulation of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 1976. And, he, of course, he went on television and thought he was rather stupid, and he didn't realize it was Henry Kissinger's plan, and he got fired. But if you look at what's happening today with the DU, what it's doing to Iraq, I mean, probably in 20 years' time, the Iraqi population will have decreased by some 50%.
Well, what we're facing right now in the world is a need to get this information further afield and have more people sign on to the effort we're making. And, of course, it's a game of inches for us. We don't get the big mouthpieces. We don't get the big venues. And we're basically a grassroots organization, Neil. And, you know, we've been able to make a dent here. 10,000 people is nothing to sneeze at, but it's certainly not going to make a big difference in the world unless we get 100,000. And I can tell you, 100,000 people would be a key to shaking up the world because, you know, then when we speak with 100,000, you have to listen.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's up to your listeners to get up off their butts and do something now, because they should think not just, oh, well, it's only affecting the Iraqis and so on, the Iranians. It's affecting them and their children. Did you see the lung cancer rates in America now?
Yeah.
They've had as many in January and February, new lung cancer cases amongst non-smokers than they had in all of 2005. 170,000 new cases in 2 months. And this can only be down to DU poisoning. And you've got, 350,000 GIs suffering from DU poisoning from Gulf War One. I mean, there's one thing that the American government doesn't give a damn about the Iraqis. And you remember Madeleine Albright's famous quotation that she thought 500,000 dead Iraqi children was a price worth paying to get rid of Saddam. But the American government hasn't given a damn about its own troops.
I think it's by design. I think they're trying to emasculate the American military.
Well, emasculate the American military and then bring in all these Mexican illegal aliens and what's left of America?
Nothing.
They want to destroy it and move on.
That's right, they do. They want to take it down because it's one of the only countries that had any possible opportunity that would, you know, to stop these folks. And, of course, once America's gone, I mean, you know, Britain doesn't have private guns. And, you know, what are you going to do, throw rocks at the people controlling you?
Well, since the banning of handguns in the UK, same thing happened in Australia. Armed crime has gone through the roof.
Yeah.
It's soared. And do you ever hear, you know, the Dunblane massacre, which precipitated the ban on weapons in the UK? Have you heard about it at all?
Yes, I had.
About the paedophile aspect?
No.
Well, the man who committed the massacre is a guy called Thomas Hamilton. And he's Hamilton, I know that. And he applied for a gun license, and the local police said, don't give it to this guy, we're investigating him to be, you know, for paedophilic activities. But he belonged to the lodge, the Masons. And the deputy chief constable also belonged to the same lodge, and he, I believe, wrote a letter allowing him to have a license. Well, after the massacre, they had a public inquiry. Now, the public inquiry, the findings were sealed to the public for 100 years. Now, when you have spy scandals, they only get sealed for 30 years, yeah? So why was this sealed for 100 years? Well, apparently, the story is that Hamilton was running a high-level paedophile ring for members of the British establishment. And that's why the evidence has been suppressed for 100 years.
And this is like Mark Dutroux doing it for the establishment in Brussels, and we've had the same kind of scandals over here in France. And we've, of course, a big scandal with if you know anything about. I had him on recently. I forget his name. It's terrible. But we know that this stuff, the pedophilia in amongst these people as well. I mean, when I talked in the first part of this before the interview started, I talked a little bit about child pornography and pornography in general being run by these same people.
Mm-hmm.
And John DeCamp was a senator in Nebraska, and he wrote a book called the Franklin Cover Up.
You hear about it, yeah.
Yeah, and this got all the way up to the Bush White House and possibly to Reagan, and all the top leadership were flying children around from a Catholic orphanage for children, and they were supplying these children for sex in Washington and other parts of the country. And of course, you and I know that these elites have been doing this forever. And the very idea that this is what goes on is it shocks people to the point where they can't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, Neil, if somebody 20 years ago had said this to you, you'd look at them and go, get out of here. People don't do that. I mean, maybe sick people do, but they're not our leaders.
Well, this stuff goes on and it's well hidden. The Hamilton affair led to some guy writing on a discussion group of the Scottish Sunday Herald, naming names, some of the top people in British government, and nobody came out to sue.
Now, who were some of the names that came out?
Well, he mentioned Gordon Brown.
Ah.
Peter Mandelson. And Peter Mandelson's a very interesting character. Have you ever heard of him?
Yes,
he was sacked from the British government, or the British cabinet, twice. You know, he took out a mortgage for £350,000 and never notified his mortgage company. And his grandfather was Herbert Morrison. This is the man who locked up people in the 30s in Britain under what they call Regulation 18B. This was used initially to lock up suspected members of the IRA in the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't put them away on perfect evidence, so anyone accused someone, they could lock them up. And this is in Britain. This is Stalinist.
Yeah.
Now, in the 30s, there was, well, the head of British Naval Intelligence, Sir Admiral Barry Domville. He was against the war. He realized what was going on, and he was trying to get the people to know. There were MPs involved. There were lords, ladies, dukes, duchesses. They were all slammed up in Brixton Nick for trying to speak out against the war. Under Regulation 18B, you'd get a knock on the door. There'd be a policeman. You've been accused of this. Who's my accuser? I want to confront him. You cannot. You have no right. What is the evidence? We don't have to show you. Follow me, sir. And they
that sounds a lot like the Patriot Act.
well, we had it first.
Yeah. Yes. So basically there's nothing new under the sun, Neil.
No, but Herbert Morrison, then, he was foreign minister for a socialist government in Britain's in the 50s. And when Mohammed Mossadegh in Iran said, look, this oil is for the Iranian people, not the foreign oil companies. I'm going to nationalize all the oil companies. And as you know, the British and American colluded and ousted him. Now, Herbert Morrison, when he heard Mossadegh say that he's going to nationalize, this socialist foreign secretary said, hey, this is not the kind of socialism we like.
Well, now, Mendelssohn, that sounds like a Jewish name to me, isn't
it? Oh, yeah, he's Jewish, yeah.
Ah.
And there's another one. I'm not sure he still is, but he was head of NATO, a guy called Robinson.
Yeah.
And he said that he was going to sue, but nothing ever happened. I mean, one of the heads of Zionism in the UK is a guy called Greville Janner. And he is a well-known paedophile. And he's untouchable. In fact, he used to perform double acts with an ex-Speaker of the House of Commons. And fortunately, he was a Welshman, George Thomas. And this has been going on. I mean, even David Irving has been implicated.
Well, that's another one I want to bring up. You've been to the site that we gave the world a dose of our take on Irving, and of course we've been slammed by people who don't know any better about Irving. But he of course has been implicated in lots of sick acts. This guy.
Well, there's a British guy over here. He's one of the best revisionists I know. A guy called Al Barron, and he went after Irving for one reason or another, and he managed to find some rent boys who signed sworn affidavits that Irving had employed them for their services. So he went, and he, at the time, he didn't know that this guy, Janner, was a paedophile. So he got in touch with his office and met up with some of Janner's men and handed them the affidavits. And they just showed Al some pictures of Irving in a rather compromising position with a young black boy.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, Al, you don't understand. He's one of ours. Leave it alone.
Yeah.
You know, Irvine, he's not a revisionist. He hasn't written anything. The only thing he's done on revisionism is the foreword for the Luchter Report. And that's about it. I mean, you know, one of the things he's in jail for in Austria, I believe, is 10, 15 years ago, he was found guilty in absentia for saying that the gas chamber shown to tourists at Auschwitz was built after the war by the Russians. In other words, it was a fabrication.
Mm-hmm.
He was sentenced for that. And
yeah.
Even the curator of Auschwitz, Francesca Pieper, has come out and admitted it. But you can still go to jail for denying it.
Well, I think they probably said, well, you're going to go to jail on whatever we say you're going to go to jail for, or we're going to show this picture of this little black boy in you.
Well, who knows, but Irving plays a funny game. I mean, he's not that good a historian, according to Al Barron. He's torn some of his books apart, you know, but not perfect research, shall we say.
Well, you know, the work I'd like to do with you in the future, I'd like to maybe have you do a little research into finding out some actual participation of Jews within the Nazi regime, and point out to the rest of the world that this regime was not the Aryan regime that has been portrayed, but rather a meritocracy where whoever could get the job done was actually put in place, or whoever had the influence got you the job. And this is the way the Nazi Party worked. I mean, if you needed money, you went to Max Warburg. If you needed, bomb material, you got DuPont from America to send you the makings for it. If you needed engines, you got in touch with Ford, and they gave you a patent that built the motor, and on.
Well, they supplied for the German panzer tanks.
That's right.
And ITT provided the electronics that the Stuka dive bomber used.
Yeah.
I mean, it look, war is business. I mean, it was only there was no declaration of war between America and Vietnam, right?
Right.
It just developed. And only that provided half of the American businessmen for not being arrested for high treason, because they were all dealing. I think there were four trucks being driven down the Ho Chi Minh Trail. You know, war is business. Hey, you know, let's not mess around with it. I mean, there's a bank called the BICC, Bank of International Settlements.
Yeah.
And it was in Switzerland. It's still there, apparently.
Yep.
And during the war, it was full of Germans, Americans, Brits. They all worked together. Because there's always one victor in war, and that is the banks. Because every time a country comes out in debt, banks love wars. I mean, the only time a country came out of a war with no debt was after Abe Lincoln printed his greenbacks to finance the Civil War. And we all know what happened to him.
That's right. Well, you know, I'd like to carry on with this, but I don't want to go on too long. I just want to invite you back on a more specific subject the next time.
Mm-hmm.
This was an opportunity for our listeners to get a chance to get to know you a little bit. And on our next conversation, Neil, we'll select a couple of subjects I'll ask you about, and we'll try to plumb the depths of those particular issues.
That all depends on whether I'm spending an extended holiday at Her Majesty's expense. You know, if I'm still around, I'll be on, okay?
Well, they're not going to do anything to you because, you know what, the French Connection make too much noise.
Okay, hold you to that. As you say, I'll sleep safe tonight, Dara.
All right, sir. Thank you so much, Neil.
All right.
All right, now, bye-bye.
Au revoir, monsieur.
Au revoir. And that was my friend Neil Turner. He was he's a great researcher and a wonderful fighter for the truth. And you know, ladies and gentlemen, we don't often get frankness like that. And again, it really points out the idea that this is a battle that all of us need to be fighting, because he's not kidding when he says he may be taken away in the night. They do have rules, they do have interests, and they do exercise these criminalities against us. And boy, it's a tough fight we're fighting here, and we do need your help. We desperately do. And but you know, Neil's a real hero, and my hat's off to him. This is a French Connections Thursday edition, and we will be back again tomorrow with another interview. We have one coming up for you. It's going to be interesting. But until then, I will wish you all well, and talk to you very soon. Bye-bye now.